25 minutes after the hour on a therapeutic Thursday, and that means we're joined by Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie is the Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times, an Anglican pastor. He's coming to us from Ashburn, Virginia, which is right next to Loudoun County, where all the news is being made about school boards. Still, Robbie,
it's
still
in Loudoun County, nonetheless.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm glad it's Therapeutic Thursday. I'm here for my therapy.
Okay, well, you get some.
good to be with you, Jim and David. It's a delight as always.
Robbie, we're on a great track through the book of Luke here, but I want to ask you something first. I know you spent, and we've talked about it a number of times, you worked at the Museum of the Bible, and I was just quizzing David off the air earlier. What do you call one of those people that work and represent a living being from the time that's on display there? And I, because I asked him, he couldn't answer me. If I hadn't asked him, he would have come up with it right away.
It was a docent. I told you.
A living history interpreter.
Interpreter. There's the key word.
Yeah. Okay. Interpreting history for the viewer.
How do they prepare you for that? How do you get trained to be a living history interpreter for the Museum of the Bible? That means seminary probably, huh?
Well, you know, when the Museum of the Bible was opening up, I mean, that thing was done in 5 years from ground concept to, like, doors opening. So they kind of built the plane while they flew it.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, this is in Washington, D.C., by the way, for our listeners.
That's just correct. So, yeah, Museum of the Bible, Washington, D.C., a wonderful place, one of my favorite playgrounds in the area. I'll go and study for hours. There's 9 8-hour mm-hmm. days worth of content in the museum, over 430,000 square feet on 7 different levels. It's
wow.
a beautiful facility. It's a museum to the book, but also a monument to the book. But we helped write those talking points, me and two other docents. We brought in the contextual first century study. I was gleaning from Doug Greenwald's material,
yes,
Preserving Bible
excellent
Times.
Material for that. Yeah. Okay.
So they picked up that maybe I had read something somewhere one day and knew a little bit of something about it.
You sounded authoritative then, didn't you?
And they said, can you help us put words in the mouths of these actors? And then the next thing I knew, they said, could you put this costume on while these actors learn their lines? And can you help us with opening day? And I'll never forget a reporter weeping in front of the Galilee View as I told Bible stories in character. And I was hooked. I was like,
well, that would do it.
If he's seeing the scriptures for the first time and is coming alive in this capacity, I want to be a part of this. So
okay,
let's
say I'm a visitor to the Bible, to the Museum of the Bible. And I'm deep into the culture of the first century in Israel, and I'm thinking, you know, this was an agrarian culture. 90% of the people worked the land; they were in the fields during the day. Much of it is a very hot place, and a hard place to work outside all day. So I would ask the living history interpreter, did anybody in Israel in those days wear a hat?
Well, it's funny. I actually had my head wrapped with a headscarf, so they wouldn't have to ask the question. Part of being a living history interpreter.
That sounds hot. That sounds hot. How about a straw hat? I mean, I'm thinking back to my wife's grandfather on the farm in Kentucky, and he would cover himself up not to get sunburned, and always wear a farmer type hat to keep the sun off his neck and his face. How did they protect themselves then and there? I never see anybody from the Bible depicted with a hat other than priests with a ceremonial headdress and Roman soldiers with a helmet.
Yeah, and commoners that were out in the field and doing agricultural work would have had their heads wrapped with cloth.
Mm.
And so we actually had our heads wrapped. But what you're doing there is what we all do. We read the Bible and we overlay our culture on top of it instead of looking at the scripture through a first century worldview to put on our secret decoder glasses and look at it the way they saw it, not the way we see it. So we have to kind of be time travelers as we look at the biblical context. We do not ask what a passage means to us until we first ask what it meant to its original hearers.
Okay, question number two. If they'd had cell phones, would Jesus have still drawn an audience?
If they had cell phones. As a pastor, that's a question I ask every Sunday as we have a Zoom congregation and we have people in the room. and everything in between. You know, we've got people watching the live feed later on YouTube.
You have your cell phone ring in the middle of your sermon?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've had people answer it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's where you know you've got to do some work on
That's
your sermon.
Right. That's right. That's right.
If you can't keep things interesting enough to keep people from answering the phone, you got problems, you know?
Okay, then there's this my question number three. In Luke 10, Jesus goes through the parables, and there's like last week we talked about the 70 or the 72 he sent out. And when you get down to the bottom of Luke 10, it just says simply, he went to Mary and Martha's house, that they were sisters. And I got to, you know, Luke researched, he interviewed people, he got the important stuff from people who were eyewitnesses or a part of Jesus' ministry for 3.5 years, and he put it down on paper. He wanted a comprehensive account. Why is this even included? What's the significance here?
Yeah, and don't skip the parable of the Good Samaritan, right?
Oh, that's,
right
that's
there
key.
After the sending out of the 72, they return,
mm-hmm.
and then the lawyer approaches Jesus and teaches one of the most famous parables in all of Scripture, second only to maybe the prodigal sons or the prodigal God, mm-hmm. depending on who you're asking. Then, of course, yeah, we go right into
he gives three parables intentionally, all having to do with lost stuff. A lost
right.
sheep, a lost coin, a lost son. So that's all heavy-duty stuff that we're all taught about in Sunday school. Hardly
Luke
anybody,
15.
Yeah, but hardly anybody mentions Mary and Martha. Why is that significant? Why is it in the Bible?
And specifically in Luke's gospel, you're asking a great question. So the parable of the Good Samaritan, you can find it. You know, in Luke chapter 10, but mm-hmm. the, you know, parable of the prodigal son is only, parables of the lost things are only in Luke 15.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I got that confused. But those were the three parables in Luke 15 then. So this is the Good Samaritan, which is an amazing story in itself. That's heavy duty stuff. And there's all kinds of context in there. But in verse 38, it says simply, as Jesus and his disciples were on their way, I'm not sure where. Probably to Jerusalem, they came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary. Don't we already know these people from Lazarus?
Yeah, if you're reading John's Gospel, John chapter 11, we see this account of Lazarus, the raising of Lazarus, and it's Martha who comes to Jesus and says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. So you kind of get the birth order there.
Mm-hmm.
If Martha is the one that's taking responsibility to approach the rabbi and question him, most likely she is the elder sister.
I'm not sure if that's valid with the people of the feminine persuasion, though. I mean, men and women were different creatures in this society. The oldest male was the guy with the birthright. I don't know that women had any. Maybe they followed that pattern, though, almost subconsciously, how the older woman would have had some sort of authority.
Sure. I mean, birth order is still, you know, effective today in terms of, you know, in my house, our oldest daughter is pretty much ruling the roost and taking care of the younger kids, and they kind of establish themselves as, you know, the leader. And so we get some insight that most likely Martha is the older person, and it's Martha's house in Luke chapter 10 mm-hmm. that they go to. So we see this, that they a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house.
It does say her home, not
that's right.
not their home.
So again, that's insight that most likely Martha is the older sister who has ownership of this property.
Mary is incidental, except for the next two sentences here. Then she grabs center stage.
She's the focus. Yeah, mm-hmm. I would say she's not incidental at all. I would say that Martha would probably like her to be incidental.
Mm-hmm.
but that therein lies the rub. You've got an older sister doing all the serving in her house. You've got a younger sister who most likely lives with Martha. Most likely both of these women are single, which is why there's no mention of a husband or a male in this room or in this home with them.
And of course, Lazarus was their brother, so there was not a marriage relationship going on here.
Right. Mm-hmm. So now we're stepping into some context that actually gives some tension to this story. Like the rabbi is in a home with two women. Mm-hmm. One is assuming a servant's role. Now, Jesus could be very much in the courtyard of this home. Usually a home has a cooking courtyard. If it's a wealthy home, it has its own cooking courtyard. If it's a lower income, this cooking courtyard might be central in the village and shared. So most likely, Martha is taking possession of the family home. It is a larger home of a wealthier woman. And Jesus is friends with Mary and Martha. We gather this from the account that you mentioned, rightfully so, in John chapter 11, where the raising of Lazarus. We know that this is his friend, and he waits before he goes, so that everyone knows that this resurrection account is indeed a resurrection.
Can we judge the timing of this visit to Martha's home before or after the raising of Lazarus?
You know, that's a good question. And I can't tell, you know, with the scripture not being linear, I would say that this could potentially, most likely, be before the raising of Lazarus.
My impression is that Luke tends to be more linear and chronological than the other gospel accounts. So that's a clue. If that's true, then this is probably earlier than the raising of Lazarus.
Yeah, because keep in mind, when John writes his gospel, it's pretty much jumping right into the last days of Jesus. Mm-hmm. It pretty much gets to...
It's retrospective.
This account in this account of raising Lazarus is the straw that breaks the camel's back to have Jesus crucified. So this is towards the end of his ministry, where this particular account is most likely at the beginning of the ministry.
Okay, so it's early, and still I don't know what makes it significant.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And
David,
let me one more thought here. There's no mention of Lazarus at all, so we don't even, he may not even be around.
Does he live somewhere else? Does he have his own home?
Is he
married and have his own home? We don't know. Mm-hmm. But let's look at the beauty of this passage. Why is it here and why is it significant? Number one, it's only in Luke's gospel. We only get this account in this gospel. Luke is 24 chapters of glory. We know that Luke writes most of the New Testament, verse by verse. His verse count outnumbers Paul's. So Luke is a Gentile physician, most likely a servant. Many of the physicians would take a slave role, not as we think it, but as a indentured servant to serve others. We know Luke took this role in Acts as he traveled with Paul and was most likely his physician, Paul's physician. And we see that Luke is actually writing Luke Acts, this two-part series that many scholars could believe that this is actually the documents that go before Paul when he could potentially be going on trial. Chuck Missler actually has this piece of information in some of his commentary, which I find fascinating, which could be why it's so linear, why it's so comprehensive, and why it's interviewing eyewitnesses.
Uh-huh.
These are two eyewitnesses. Mary and Martha are friends of
Jesus. It's like almost like a deposition.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. And now we've got all this January 6th trial stuff going on. We know the importance of this testimony and who saw what and when. So Luke is gathering a comprehensive account of these things, including details like this that other gospel writers leave out. Now, why is it significant that Martha is serving? That's actually not the significant piece. Any woman in a first century culture would be doing her duty, as it would be an honor to have a esteemed rabbi come into your home. You would be honored by that visit, and you would want to honor in an honor and shame culture, you would want to honor the rabbi by presenting your very, very best expression of
hospitality. It would be required.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but expected culturally. And indeed, if this is the preparations happening in the outdoor cooking courtyard, there is no roof here. And all the neighboring homes, people could look over into that or even climb the walls. Young kids would climb, you know, trees if they were near. They would get up on the roofs of the other homes to look down. I mean, this is dinner television for these folks in the first century. This is today's entertainment. We're going to go see the rabbi over the wall in the cooking courtyard over at Mary and Martha's. Can you believe he's there? And so she is doing her duty by expressing herself in love and hospitality to the rabbi. Now, Mary is doing something completely different. She is sitting at Jesus's feet. This is the very posture of a disciple. So this is a man's role in this culture, to sit at the feet of a rabbi, not a woman's role. They would not sit, women and men would learn separately and would not be disciples of a rabbi.
Women, young girls, didn't even go to school. They had to learn from their older brothers.
Well, and everyone was homeschooled. As the women would teach their young daughters how to care for the home, how to cook and clean and take care of the chores, the domestic duties in the household, they would teach their daughters the Torah.
But
and the law.
But the schools may be held in synagogue. Is that midrash? Is that the word for that?
The educational system? Well, everybody goes to the synagogue on Sabbath morning. Mm-hmm. Everyone. Mm-hmm. And they go there to learn. But the Torah, this is an integrated approach to learning that the Jews do, that we think, well, I'm going to go to school and learn. Well, to the Jew, it's Deuteronomy 6. It's teach your children diligently when you lie down, when you rise up, when you walk along the way. So it's all the time. So young men, the same. They would learn their father's trade while learning the Torah and how what it means to be a man, particularly a God-fearing man. But these women and men, there were not men calling female disciples. It just didn't happen. So that you would have men sitting at the rabbi's feet as the rabbi's disciple. And let me just give you a point of reference for this, because it's biblical and it's even in Luke. We see that the man who is healed by Jesus is they find him clothed and in his right mind and sitting at the feet of Jesus. This is Luke 8:35. Then the people went out to see what happened. They came to Jesus and found the man whom the demons had gone sitting at the feet of Jesus.
That has to be a posture of submission.
Right. And this man is clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Mark's gospel gives us even further insight. Mark's gospel has this man saying, "Rabbi, I will follow you wherever you go." What did he just do? The man gave Jesus his title. "You are my teacher. You are my rabbi. I want to follow you. I want to be your disciple."
That's coded language, isn't it? It's like a rabbi said, "Come follow me," meant more than let's take a walk and talk together. It was submission. It was commitment.
That's exactly right. And so Mary assumes the posture of a disciple, and Jesus receives it. Mm. And even better, because he says that she has chosen the better part. I love the way the ESV says it. She has chosen the better portion. And that word portion in the Greek is linked even to inheritance. So the word there is meris, M-E-R-I-S in the Greek, meris, and it means the portion or the inheritance, an assigned part to share. So in the Psalms, the psalmist in like Psalm 16:5 says that the Lord is my portion. The Lord is my portion. So in other words, the Lord is my chosen portion and my cup. You hold my lot. So in other words, she is saying Jesus is my satisfaction, my satiation, my all in all. I don't need to worry about food preparations. I mean, you've heard about this in Deuteronomy. Man, Jesus says to the enemy, man shall not live by bread alone, but every word spoken out of the mouth of God. So the psalmist says in Psalm 27:4, one thing I have asked of the Lord that I will seek, that I might dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life and gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his holy temple. Again, Psalm 73:26, my flesh and my heart may fail, but God is my strength, the strength of my heart, and here's the word, and my portion forever.
I'm thinking that if, as you said, this could have been all open to the public, in open air with kids watching and people watching reputation of the community at stake, that Martha was doing all the right things by this rabbi, and here's Mary sitting at his feet, and Jesus not sending her away. That, if it was truly public, that's a powerful statement all by itself.
It is. Yes, and it absolutely is, and I believe it's happening, and we've already got precedent for it in Luke chapter 7. In Luke chapter 7, it's the sinful woman when Jesus is at Simon the Pharisee's home, okay? He's invited to a dinner party with Simon the Pharisee. A woman enters the home and washes Jesus' feet with her tears. You remember the account.
Oh, yes.
So when you're invited to someone's home, again, you're supposed to wash their feet, let them wash their hands and their face, anoint their head with oil, greet them with a kiss. Simon the Pharisee does neither. And this woman comes to do it. She comes to kiss his feet, wash his feet, anoint his feet. Simon does neither. How does she know she's not invited to the party? So there's your precedent. She knows because she's watching. She's probably watching from a window, which is acceptable culturally. If you've got somebody famous over your house, of course the community wants to be a part of it. So Doug Greenwald actually put together a wonderful document called Comparing Making Disciples Then and Now. And one of the things he talks about is the Greek mind, the Greek thinker, is always concerned about the individual. But to the Hebrew, it's not about the individual at all. It's about the community. And this is a part of the communal life together in a village life, a agricultural society in a tight-knit community where everybody's coming around. And Jesus is using it for sure to teach. Now, this account is sandwiched right after the parable of the Good Samaritan. Here we have a Samaritan, a mixed breed, as the hero. What comes next? The woman is a disciple and has chosen the good portion.
People who traditionally were on the outside are now included.
Yes, and this is what Jesus is trying to highlight. This is what Luke records in his gospel uniquely to say that the gospel, the good news, Jesus is for the riffraff, the outcast, the down and out, the Samaritan, the Gentile, the woman. You name it, Jesus is here for everyone.
See, I knew there was a reason. Had to be a reason. Luke said, hey, this has got to be, this is going to be chapter 10, he said.
And the outcrowd.
Yeah. I've learned a lot again, and still, Robbie. Great explanation. That was eating at me. Now I'm a lot more comfortable than I was before. Well, how about you, David? Did you pick something up from that, did you?
Oh, man. Wow. Yeah. I mean, all of a sudden, it's much like the Doug Greenwald moments where you just lift up the little piece of acetate that you've been writing on, and all the words disappear, and then the words come back.
Yeah. an aha moment. Yeah.
It's clear.
Yeah. Robbie, we're grateful to you.
Thank you, Robbie.
I want to mention again, you know, Robbie, as I mentioned, is the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. It's a wonderful ministry with just oodles and tons of materials that constitute the biblical context that teaches you what's between the lines in all those gospel readings that you do. When you sit down and study your Bible, there are a number of things you should have by your side there, including a couple, three, four different Bibles, as Doug explains elsewhere. You can examine those materials at preservingbibletimes.org. You can link to them from our website at brokenroadradio.com. We recommend that you do. And a lot of what they have now is being converted to streamable material. In other words, books that Doug wrote are now available as ebooks online. And DVDs that he's done are becoming streamable online with a mouse click. So give them a look and see what you think. PreservingBibleTimes.org. Robbie, thanks so much. Great time together today, and we'll see you next week.
Joy to be with you, gentlemen. We'll see you next week. Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.
See you, Robbie.